Hey everyone, and welcome back to Travel Notes. It's so great to be back. I'm your host, Grace McNally, and this is our first episode of season 5. Today we have an incredibly inspiring guest. I can't wait for you to meet them. And before we dive in, I want to extend a huge thank you to Ohm Radio 96.3 for broadcasting our show locally in Charleston, South Carolina, and to all of you who are tuning in and listening. If you're a fan of the show, you can find us online at travelnotes_podcast on social media or on my website, gracemcnallymusic.com, under the Travel Notes tab. Today's special guest, Jacob Edgar, is an ethnomusicologist, a world music tastemaker, and global explorer with an insatiable curiosity for the diverse ways in which people express themselves through music. So a perfect guest for Travel Notes. Jacob's adventures have taken him to dozens of countries and hundreds of the world's greatest international music festivals, showcases, and performance venues in search for exceptional musical talents. Since 1998, Jacob has been the main music researcher for the acclaimed music compilations label Putumayo World Music, contributing songs and liner notes to over 300 of Putumayo's collections that combined have sold over 15 million copies. In 2006, Jacob founded the record label Kumbancha, whose artists include some of the top names in the international music scene. In 2009, Jacob embarked on a new adventure as a host of a music and television program, Music Voyager. The series invites viewers to discover the exciting sounds of the planet and broadcasts on PBS and other stations around the world. While pursuing his undergraduate degree at Oberlin College, where he was a double major in history and Latin American studies, Jacob conducted field research on music and society in Central America. His love of music took him to the West Coast, where he was awarded the Mellon Fellowship in the Humanities and graduated from University of California, Los Angeles in 1994 with a master's in ethnomusicology. Now that you know a little bit more about Jacob's background, I hope you enjoy our conversation. Okay, so Jacob, I want to start and talk about your awesome career because you do have the coolest jobs in the world. Do you always know what you wanted to do professionally?
Well, I knew that ever since I was young, I was always interested in music. So I really knew that I wanted to have some sort of musical career, although I wasn't really blessed with great musical talent as a performer, even though I played music my whole life. And I was also interested in travel and history and culture and, learning about languages and people from around the world. And it wasn't until I got to college that I discovered that there was a field of study called ethnomusicology. So I was studying history and Latin American studies and started to take my first ethnomusicology courses when I was in college. And that's pretty much when I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I didn't know what I was going to do with this passion and this interest. I had no idea that it would lead me down the paths that it has. I just knew that it was a topic I was interested in, and I wanted to spend time focusing on it. And one thing led to another, and here I am after 30 plus years of incredible career and life. So
wow.
I'm happy at it. Yeah.
Yeah. So because when you started, how big of a scene, quote unquote, was there in ethnomusicology? Like, obviously, there must have been classes in college and degrees, but what was the terrain like?
Well, I meet a lot of people who, as I was at that time, who had no idea that the field of ethnomusicology existed. And even if they've heard that it existed, they thought it was the most esoteric and small community. But it's actually a pretty large scene. If you think about it, almost every college or university, if they have some sort of music program, they're also likely to have an ethnomusicology professor or at least courses, because no self-respecting music program can do all Western classical music all the time, right? There's got to be some jazz in there. There's got to be some world music, quote unquote. They have to explore the diversity of human expression, or else, they're being very single-minded and culturally blind. So there actually are a lot of ethnomusicology professors working in academia and or either in music programs, but also in history departments or anthropology departments or variety. They can fit into a lot of different niches. In addition to that, there are a lot of what I would call unofficial ethnomusicologists, people who are maybe not trained as ethnomusicologists, but often have done some of the most important work in ethnomusicology. They're just people who are passionate about music and culture. Maybe they have amazing collections, or maybe they've traveled around and recorded artists from all over the world. And sometimes you'll find that the best ethnomusicologists are the ones who can't actually claim to be officially trained as ethnomusicologists. So it's a pretty vast field. What is interesting is that the academic side of ethnomusicology is almost completely separate from the business side of the music industry. So I kind of have feet in both worlds, probably more on the industry side, the music industry side than in the academic side. But I've always been intrigued by the fact that you sort of have these two different spheres and they don't interact very often.
Why do you think that is? Just curious.
Well, academia. One of the reasons I don't work in academia is that it is a very, kind of isolating community. When I studied, I did my graduate work at UCLA in Los Angeles, and I loved what I was studying. But once you get into academia, it's less about what you're studying and more about how you navigate the politics of academia, how you maintain your position, how you get the funding you need for your projects. So I felt like there was a lot of, kind of external factors that made academia not very interesting or exciting for me. It was a little stodgy. And, I find it's like you have to focus very specifically on a particular, Tuvan throat singers in a particular region of Mongolia or something. It's like you have to be very specific. And I was just a generalist. I was interested in so many things that I couldn't imagine myself devoting my entire life to one particular type of music or one particular region or historical period or whatever it was. Meanwhile, the industry at the time that I was entering it in the early 90s, 1994, was really exploding because this was the growth of the CD era. So this was a time when you had and mega stores and chains like Tower Records and Virgin and Borders and HMV. And at that time, for about 15 years, there was a period when there were these giant record stores in Times Square and other places, and they were all trying to be completists. They wanted to have everything that was ever recorded, That was their mission in some ways. They never fulfilled that mission, but what it meant was that they were interested in bringing in a broader diversity of music at the time. So you would go, and so they were hungry to fill in their world music sections. Also, it corresponded with the rise of, Paul Simon and Graceland and David Byrne with his interest in world music and Peter Gabriel and all of these sort of big pop stars. And suddenly, what was called world music was really cool and interesting, and people were really curious about it. That's why I entered into the industry side of things, working with record distributors and eventually record labels. And it was a really exciting time to be involved with that.
Definitely. Oh my gosh. Well, and that's a perfect segue because my next question was all about Putumayo. You were one of the main researchers for them. Tell me a little bit about your experience working for them, and did you have a favorite compilation you worked on?
Oh my God. Well, I still work for Putumayo. I've been working with them for over 30 years now. And, when I first started in the music industry, I was working for a company that was importing music from around the world. So importing CDs from France and Africa and Brazil and other places. And then we started a small independent world music record label. And even at that time, in the 90, early 90s, Putumayo was only about 4 years old at that point. But even in that short period of time, they had sort of come to dominate the visibility of the world music market, mostly through non-traditional approaches to selling music. The history of Putumayo is that it came out of the retail business. The owner and the founder of the company, a guy named Dan Storper, started a small chain of clothing and import stores, and they were selling you know, clothing and handicrafts and artwork from all over the world. It's like a multicultural sort of, you know, if you've ever been to like 10,000 villages or a place like that, similar concept. And he started playing background music in the store that reflected the types of products that he was carrying. And one day he walked into his shop and one of the attendants had created like, had put on heavy metal or something, you know, music that he was just found wildly inappropriate to the setting. So he started making mixtapes for the store and then eventually said, oh, people kept asking what the music was. And so he started making actual compilations for sale. And their branding, their approach to branding, their approach to, you know, creating colorful artwork, the music selections that they made were really meant to sort of pull people who didn't know that much into it. And so in the early days, when I first started noticing Putumayo, I was actually a little bit jealous of them. You know, I was like, oh, this is so simplistic. You know, that they're the best of world music. What does that mean? You know, I was still sort of in an academic mindset, but also a competitive mindset. You know, I saw them as a competitor and they were sort of keeping us out of the space. But then one year I ran into Dan, the president of Putumayo, at a music conference in New Orleans, and we just really hit it off. You know, we connected, we spoke a bit. He had noticed some of the work I was doing with my record label. And at that time, Putumayo was really growing. And he said, how would you like to be our first official music researcher? And your job will be to listen to music and travel around the world looking for great songs. Would you be interested in that? So I said, oh, well, let me think about it. Spoke to my wife and said, you know, yeah, I think I'd like to do this. So I ended up joining Putumayo, and it hasn't stopped. I'm still doing that job all these years later. That was in 98. So it's not quite 30 years, but pretty close.
Yeah. That is so cool. What an amazing moment. I bet it's cool to look back to and see how all the pieces kind of fell together.
Yes, it did. It was not, you know, like I said at the beginning, I didn't know where this passion or this interest was going to lead, but one thing just kind of led to another, from grad school to entering the music industry to meeting with Putumayo. Then eventually I started my own record label, Kumbansha, which is more focused on artist development. And then I was contacted by a TV producer and we worked on a music travel series called Music Voyager. We did 9 seasons of this music and travel show that aired on PBS stations and stations all over the world. And then eventually I also connected with Lindblad Expeditions and National Geographic Travel and started working with them and traveling on these incredible ship trips around the world where I would invite musicians to travel with us and perform in unusual locations and introduce people to the history and the culture of the destinations we were visiting through music. And so all of these things sort of one led to the other, but I couldn't have predicted that that's what I would end up doing. So it's been pretty fun, pretty exciting. I've led a pretty exciting life.
Yeah, definitely. And just as a side, just for people who might be listening and for you, I mentioned this, I think, over email, but this show, the first episode of this show, the entire show was, I actually got the idea for it from a Putumayo, the Mali to Memphis compilation.
Oh, really?
Did you work on that?
I did. Yeah. That was one of the first ones. So that was one of the early ones.
That is one of my favorites. Yeah. My mom is a big, she's who introduced me and my siblings to Putumayo and world music. They're Peace Corps volunteers and, you know, traveled all over. And so, yeah. And I just like opened my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, this is I think I even used some of the liner notes like in the show. Like it was, yeah. Absolutely. So
I wrote those liner notes too. So,
well, thank you. It's incredible, inspiring work. And that's 4 years ago.
You heard this that recently, 4 years ago, because we produced that compilation back in probably 2000 or 2002 or, you know, early 2000s.
Yeah. So I was familiar with the CD. It wasn't until the pandemic, though, that I really started the show, like had the idea to even do this kind of thing, travel through basically music, because of the pandemic, and not being able to travel and all that. So I was familiar with it. I grew up listening, like we would go to Barnes and Noble and like listen to Putumayo with my mom, growing up and stuff. So it was definitely part of the fabric of our home. I'm also just so excited to have you on the show because it
Well, that's
feels.
beautiful. And that's, that for me has been, that type of story I've heard from a lot of people, who the impact of the Putumayo collections did in many ways has changed people's trajectories in life, because I think I describe it as more of a mindset, what we're trying to connect with. Who's our audience? The audience is really people who have a certain perspective on the world, right? Like they're interested in finding out about the world around them. That would be sort of the common thread. And music, as you know, and as you've experienced, is such a magnificent tool for getting people to understand that mindset and practice it in their lives. So it's been really gratifying to know that over the years, people's kind of understanding of the world around them has been changed through these simple little CD compilations.
Absolutely. Yeah, the power of music to really do that. And I this is kind of this was a question I had along those lines is like through your work as an ethnomusicologist and traveler, music researcher, musician, what's one of the most important like lessons would you say you've taken away over the last almost 30 years?
I mean, I think the common thread in all of my experiences is that music is important to people. I think that we have this attitude about music and the arts in general that they're not necessary for human life. They're not like food, water, having a good job, all of these types of things. And that may be true for some people that music is not central to them, but in my experience, music is such a important expression, not just artistic expression. It's an expression of culture. It's an expression of history, of language, of politics, of identity, of economics. It's almost like a lens through which you can experience so many aspects of what it means to be human in this world. And I think music is a very unique form of expression in that way. Unlike, let's say, tactile arts like painting or literature, things like that, poetry, music kind of encapsulates a lot of those elements into one type of art form. And it's capable of reaching people very deeply in their emotions, in their brains. It has people have physical responses to music. It's a really interesting art form, and yet we don't really totally understand what it's all about, why we make music, what is music. There's so many questions that are constantly being asked that are never really able to be answered, but I find it really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Same. It is a mystery, honestly. And that's part of the every show episode I do, interview I do, it's always interesting to hear people's perspectives on, how music crosses borders and, it can affect people from. You can listen to something from West Africa and have never been there, or maybe don't even speak the language that the music's in, but it still moves you
Oh,
in some
yes.
way.
Yeah.
So what keeps you motivated as a music tastemaker and ethnomusicologist? What are some of the things that you keeps you going, when it gets tough out there?
Yeah, I mean, the industry it's a really challenging industry. It's especially now, it's always been difficult. Every period of the music industry in particular has had its own unique frustrations and challenges. And now we're at a time that's a real crux with digital media, and even now, even more with AI, and with you know, sort of the whole way in which people experience music is transforming constantly. So it's always a struggle to keep up with all of those changes and adapt and sort of try new things and experiment. And also, it can be really depressing sometimes to think how many artists are out there struggling to make money or to make a living doing this. How many people are getting rich, sort of exploiting millions of people. The way that technology works, it can be really disheartening sometimes. You're like, this is like pushing a rock up a mountain forever. But the thing that keeps me going, numerous things keep me going. I mean, personally, I love discovery. I love the experience of discovering new music and new artists and getting excited about new voices that I wasn't familiar with before, or artists who go in interesting and different directions. So, the process of listening to music, I always enjoy. There's never a time. There are times when I'm like, oh, I've got to get through 3,000 songs by tomorrow. That can be a hassle. But even the process of doing that can be fun, because you're going to find some gems in that moment. But the things that are really gratifying for me are some of those stories, like what you were telling me about your personal experience and the impact that these projects can have on people. I love the idea that the work that I'm doing may trickle down and have some kind of, it might be a small little impact, but it could affect people in some way. And it certainly helps the artists. Part of the reason that I love what we do at Putumayo, but all of the projects that I'm involved in, is that I feel there's just some really exceptional talents out there, and many, many artists who deserve to be heard and aren't able to get heard, either because they come from places really, really far away. They don't have, other than their creative skills, they don't have the skills of self-promotion and marketing and all of that stuff that artists need. Or they're just ignored by the algorithms, these faceless bots that are programming what we're supposed to be listening to. And so, hearing from the musicians that have been featured on our projects, or I've invited onto the ship, or I've been on the TV show, or all of these things, hearing from them how important it's been in their careers, or what a great experience it was for them, that to me, I just love. I love knowing that in some little way we're helping people or giving them a unique experience and opportunity that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Totally. With the one concept this show we talk about and I like to explore is, how musical styles show up across the world. Like, and they might be from other places. Like, for example, I was down in Salvador de Bahia, but Brazil, like northeast of Brazil, and learned some rhythms that I then, when I got back to Charleston, heard here in Charleston, South Carolina, through the Gullah rhythms here.
And oh, really?
Yeah, so this Baião rhythm from the Northeast Brazil, is the exact same rhythm as the Gullah clap here in Charleston.
Oh, amazing.
Which is so totally wild. Yeah, it's like, and so that kind of thing, like, have you found that those kind of like common threads amongst your travels and work?
Oh yes. I mean, music is music is something that travels with us, even if we have no possessions, of course, right? Music lives within us. And so as long as people have been leaving their little communities and traveling to other parts of the world, music has traveled with them. And it's either maintained threads to the places where they originated from, or it has reflected the interaction of different people coming together and trading musical information, right? And so you see throughout the world, the reflection of history in music in ways that sometimes are evidence of historical developments that historians weren't even aware of. But you know, I mean, one example, it's, you know, is the banjo, you know, this instrument that has become such a icon of what I would call like white Appalachian culture, you know, of bluegrass, of sitting on your front porch and Beverly Hillbillies and Deliverance and all of these images that we have of the banjo in popular culture. And, you know, I bet you a vast number of people don't realize that the banjo is an African instrument. It was brought here to the New World by West Africans, enslaved West Africans. And through a trajectory of interaction and popular performance became adopted, brought by the broader white culture, and became identified with that culture. But you'll also see, you know, incredible sort of common threads that tie communities together that people didn't necessarily know were connected with each other. You know, I've worked quite a bit with the Garifuna community in Central America, and the Garifuna are the descendants of enslaved Africans on ships who were shipwrecked off the coast of a Caribbean island, and they escaped into the island and were harbored by the local Arawak and Carib Indian communities, Native American communities, and lived with them for you know, 100 years or more, and develop this cross, you know, this pan-African New World culture and a new language and musical elements and all of this stuff sort of fused together into a new cultural expression. And then through colonial history, they got in wars with the British and captured and shipped off to different locations and ended up off the coast of Central America. And so you have this pocket of a very unusual community that for many years was mysterious and people didn't know where they came from or how it originated. And through the process of historical, through legend and, you know, myth and all of that stuff, and then historical documentation, and now more recently DNA testing and things like that, we're starting to understand more about the history of these communities. And it's probably the same with the Gullah. You know, it's actually a similar type of trajectory. You know, these communities of people that broke off at one point from the broader African-American community and maintained elements of culture in that place that they weren't able to in other parts of society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's the Gullah, you know, here, their music really became the foundation for, you know, I mean, it was in the church now. It's like the hymns and then the spirituals, which is where I heard those rhythms show up again. Like, that's where I was when I heard the Baião rhythm from Brazil. But it's kind of become like, and then the foundations of, I mean, the African Americans here too are had a huge role, the Jenkins Orphanage Band with jazz. And it's really kind of fascinating. But with the, it's Garifuna?
Garifuna.
So I spent like 2 years in Nicaragua, and I think that is there a population? There's a population.
Yes. Yeah, there is. It extends down along the coast, and there are some Garifuna in Nicaragua as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So fascinating. Yeah. If you have any, I'll shoot you a message after, but if you have any recommendations of music to check out.
Oh, I have some life-changing music for you. Yes.
Yes. Awesome.
Wonderful.
What do you have an artist right now with your label, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about too. Or do you have an artist that you're working or a group that you're featuring, you're excited about, or we could talk about a bunch of the artists.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've worked with a lot of different artists on my record label, including some of the Garifuna artists I'm going to introduce you to. I've worked with artists from Sweden, from Israel, from Brazil, a lot of different places. Right now, I just recently signed a really wonderful artist from Senegal. His name is Cheikh Ibrahim, and he is just a really talented singer and songwriter, great personality, really fun performer, catchy music. but also very intelligent, sort of thoughtful, writes songs that are kind of analyzing his history and culture and society. So it's music that's fun and danceable, and you can really groove to it, but it's music with a message as well. And that's always been important to me. You know, I've never really wanted to put out music that was really just superficial in its content. I like to tell people that when I started my record label, my goal was to find the next Bob Marley. And I still haven't done that, but what I meant by that is an artist that comes from a place that's rooted in a culture, but whose music has broad appeal, could reach out to people way beyond that, where it originated, but also has a broader social message. You know, it's music that is transformative, both in its genre and its style, but also in its message. You know, as a person who believes in, you know, sort of the progressive improvement of humanity, I think music can play a role in that. And in so many cases throughout history, music has played a role in social change. So it's really important for me to find artists that are saying something. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be through their lyrics or just through the work that they're doing. You know, they're representing a threatened culture, or they're trying to generate some sort of movement in their local communities, or they're, you know, one point I was working with a band called Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars that was formed in a refugee camp during the war in Sierra Leone. And they traveled the world basically, you know, kind of inspiring people through their music and demonstrating the power of music to heal and that type of thing. So the music is as important to me as the stories behind the music and the messages of the artists that I'm working with.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And so do you take artists from all over the world, or is it, you know, is it you don't discriminate in terms of country? Like, it could be from anywhere. Is that kind of the...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's so cool.
I would say, generally speaking, I do try to find artists that I think are going to, that have a sonic, you know, there's such a wide range of music. And this is something that we deal with at Putumayo all the time. In that, if you go to the aesthetic of music, the world of music, the aesthetic is really broad. And the Putumayo aesthetic is really here, you know, in the range of sound and rhythms and all that stuff. And Kumbancha is maybe a little bit broader than Putumayo, but we're still kind of hewing to an aesthetic that we think will reach as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. So that means that while I'm really interested in and intellectually fascinated by a lot of different types of music, there aren't, you know, there's a lot of types of music that I don't really want to listen to as a consumer of music, right?
Yes.
You know, so I'm happy to hear, you know, really rootsy, raw, interesting, or creative and avant-garde music. You know, I don't put it on all the time.
Sure.
And so I'm looking for that all the time kind of music, you know, the kind of music that sticks with you for your life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense.
So, I mean, it could be a group from anywhere in the world, as long as I feel like it's going to reach, that other people can find something to connect with it. They don't necessarily have to understand it fully. They don't have to 100% get it in the same way that the people from that community get it. But they have to be able to get it in a way that works for them. And that there's sometimes boundaries. You know, this expression that music is a common language has its limits, actually. You know, there are types of music that you just don't get if you're not from that place, if you weren't brought up in that culture. That's just the way it is. I mean, if you play Beethoven for somebody in Papua New Guinea, they're probably going to say that doesn't really do much for me, you know? So that's just the way music is.
That's a really interesting perspective. I like that you said that, because that's actually, I haven't really heard anyone yet say that before, but I think you're so right. Like, It is, I mean, it can be very universal, but it also can be very specific to you grew up listening to, and the even just like the scales, like the, just the music itself, like the grammar of the music making sense from where you are from in verse.
Absolutely. There's a lot of music that defies Western music theory. A lot of music that falls outside of the tonal boundaries that we've set for our music that sounds perfectly pleasant to other people who were raised in that aesthetic, but for us can be atonal or disturbing, you know? And music is also much more about context than I think we give it credit for. You know, like we think of music as existing in isolation, sonic isolation, but music is a reflection of the world around it. So when I say not everybody can understand music from in the same way that a local person can, it's because not only when we're listening to music, we're not just listening to the sound, we're connecting with the person who made the music. We're listening to it in a political, social, historical context. We understand that music is being marketed to us by somebody who's trying to manipulate our appreciation of it in certain ways. So if I listen to Taylor Swift, for example, I'm not just listening to the songs of Taylor Swift. I'm listening to the celebrity of Taylor Swift. I'm listening to all the stories I've read about her and the TikToks and Instagram things and the gossip and I know who she's her boyfriend is and I know the story behind that song and I know so much more about that music than I do just the sound of it. And it's the same if you were to go to Greece and listen to the most popular artist in Greece right now, you might not like the music. But that's because you don't know the person behind the music. You don't know the history behind that music. And so that's always been the trick with Putumayo is to find the music that it can exist outside of its context. And that can be tricky sometimes. And I will say
Absolutely.
it isn't always the music that's the most popular in the place that it comes from either. So there can be if we do a compilation of music from, let's say, Greece, using that as an example, or any country, anytime we've done music from a particular country, it's quite rare that somebody from that country feels like we've really captured their music. And that's because they understand so much more about the music that they're experiencing that goes beyond the actual sound of it.
Yeah, I really do appreciate that perspective. The importance of context, and
Yes.
that music is universal and also not universal and specific too.
I also love that music is about community, you know? It's like people who are into certain types of music often are just into it because they're into the scene, you know? They want to hang out with people who they like or are like them. And so, you know, I had that epiphany when I went to the Grand Ole Opry, you know, for the first time. And up until then, I can't say I really got contemporary country music. I wasn't like a fan or anything. But then I was there in the room and I was like, this is amazing. This is like all of these people in this room are united as a community around this music because this music re represents a lifestyle or an attitude or a philosophy or a political movement or whatever it is. And, or even just fashion, you know? And it brought them together. And I think that's something that we don't, you know, taken out of context, we don't get that about music, you know, the communities. That's why things like Spotify algorithms and all of these computer algorithms will never quite capture and understand music fully because it's more than just about the sound or the genre. It's about so much more that goes beyond it. And that I don't think computers will ever be able to reflect that.
Yeah, the computer can't capture. I love how you said in the room, like the compute, you can't be in the room because through Spotify in the same way that you can through going to a live show, or
Be
actually,
in a chat room.
yeah, in a chat room, right? But so I guess virtually that actually could happen. But Still, though, I feel like there is something about, even just being in the place where the music is from and created, and yeah, like there's nothing quite like it.
Yes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We become very detached from the experience of music in the contemporary era, because music is just one click of a button, and has become very peripheral. It's very background as opposed to an immersive experience. And I do think that that immersive aspect of music will always continue, of course. But what it's resulted in is it's impacted the broader power of music in society, because it's personalized it more, and it has made it less part of a community experience.
Absolutely. Well, this is I we're about at time. Is there anything that you wanted to feature or plug on the show that we haven't for
Well,
compassion?
I mean, we didn't really talk too much about the things that we've been trying to do very recently with Putumayo in particular. And it relates to what I was just talking about in terms of new technology and the way in which music is listened to and discovered. And over the last, 10 years or so, I've been really struck by the changes in the way music is, the way in which music is consumed, and how people experience music. And the impact of the digital platforms on not just how we consume music, but also on the music itself. And I was struggling. Putumayo had created this, re taken this really great concept of basically putting music in front of people in places where they wouldn't expect to find it. So Putumayo would used to sell its CDs in like gift shops and bookstores and museums. And there was even a hardware store in Brooklyn where I used to live that carried Putumayo CDs. I mean, you'd find it in
Nice.
the most random places all over the world. And, people were like, oh, I was in Zanzibar and I saw Putumayo. I mean, just really
Oh,
everywhere.
wow.
And what was special about that is that it attracted people who didn't know that they were interested, right? They weren't music fans per se. Or if they were, they hadn't thought that they were fans of Brazilian music. They hadn't thought they were interested in French music. It never crossed their mind, because they were experiencing what was being delivered to them, right, through the mainstream channels. So Putumayo sort of went around the record stores, they went around the tastemakers, they went around the media, and they put it in front of people, and people were captivated by the look of it at first. They'd be like, oh, or hearing it in a shop. And demonstrated through its success that more people are interested in the music of diverse cultures than we think, and certainly that marketing people think, or the media thinks. But what has been happening recently in the digital era is that it's that sort of funneling of music taste has become even more extreme, because you have the algorithms are really sort of curating a walled world. Even though the world of music is available to us, the algorithms and the people curating the playlists at the platforms, at the DSPs, are really coming from a particular perspective and funneling you into these worlds. And so for the last number of years, I've been trying to figure out how to recreate that discovery experience of Putumayo in the digital realm. And so a few years ago, we started a Putumayo, what we call Putumayo Discovery, which is a digital-only record label. Basically, we don't produce CDs or any physical product. And we've been experimenting with ways to go beyond the algorithm and to actually sort of create our own, I wouldn't necessarily call it our own algorithm, but our own channels, our own communities within these platforms. Using the recognition of the Putumayo brand to bring people in ways that they wouldn't have been brought in before. And it's been going really, really well. I'm really excited about it. Not only because it's being successful, but also because it's demonstrating that people are hungry for it. People are not, they're not finding music that they actually want to hear. You know, it's not, they don't know where to go. When they're opening their app, they're like, gee, what should I listen to? You know, and the world is there. They have a cornucopia, a buffet of everything.
Yes.
And yet they're like, oh, it's almost too much choice.
Analysis paralysis,
We're trying to come up with ways to create a trusted, human curated guide to discovering the music of our world, of the particular, you know, with a particular mission behind it, which is to help us think beyond our own borders, our own boundaries, and to appreciate diversity and recognize what's beautiful about people everywhere, you know. So it's been really fun to work on that project.
That is really cool to know about, and just be aware of. How can people find the Putumayo Discovery and like plug into it?
So we take a two-tiered approach. We have an official Putumayo artist profile on all of the major platforms. That means you can look for us as Putumayo the artist. But basically what that means is we are re-releasing songs with the Putumayo artist profile and the original artist profile together so that people can find those artists through our artist profile. And then the second thing we've done is we've started creating official Putumayo playlists on all the major platforms. Some of these are more static playlists, and others are updated every week with new releases, not just of Putumayo songs, but of new discoveries from around the world of music. And so listeners on all the major platforms can look for Putumayo and find our artist profile and our playlist profiles and just listen and follow there. We also have a subscription service if people want to subscribe. And every month they'll get two new compilations of music from around the world with liner notes and information delivered to them every month. It's $9.95 a month. And it's a great way to just simplify your music discovery and say, okay, I may not be able to capture this vast world of music, but I know that the people at Putumayo are condensing and finding really great stuff that I should know about. And this is a good way for me to discover that music and also to support the mission that they're working on.
Amazing. Love it. And it's created by humans, which is the best
part.
Yes,
exactly. Exactly.
Well, Jacob, thank you again for being on the show. It's really been such a pleasure chatting and talking about the work you do and hearing about the world of ethnomusicology and world music. Where can people find your label online as well?
Just go to kumbancha.com. That's kumbancha.com. They can also go to jacobedgar.com, which links to kumbancha.com, and or putumayo.com. They'll find information there, and that's where they can look.
All right, guys, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in to this first episode of Travel Notes Season 5 with Jacob Edgar. I hope you found something meaningful in our conversation today and maybe even felt inspired. One of the things I love the most about doing this show is that the more I do it and the more people I speak to, the more I encounter unique perspectives that challenge my own ideas about music, its role in community, culture, and the way it tells our shared human story. To end today's show, I want to leave you with a song by the Senegalese artist Jacob mentioned earlier in the show, Cheikh Ibrahim. This is his tune, Shabida. I hope you enjoy it, and thanks again for being here. Stay tuned, because our next trip is just around the corner. Dole man sañu ma yewu di khulee.
Go right, Clinton. Spider-Man.